Is it going to be cropped? Okay, well, whatever. So I'll continue with this system of doing an introduction every once in a while. So I think this is the fifth or the sixth, okay? So again, this is an introduction, and you don't need to know anything. If you forgot anything from yesterday, and from any single day before, it's irrelevant. This is new stuff, you don't need to know anything. Okay? But later, of course, I will show that it is derived from the normal stuff. Okay? So I will follow a handout. I hope you all have a copy. Jorgen, do you have a copy?
No. I'm still doing over your job.
It's hard. Okay. So, let me warn you that there are some ugly formulas at the end. Okay? So, lovely things happen, but ugly formulas are at the end. But this is as ugly as it gets. It's basically, well, the ugly thing is that it's shaking. But, Did I eat something bad or? Anyway, so all these are very basic matrix operations. So you take one matrix and you convert it to another, but that's all. These are a bit ugly, but that's as ugly as it gets. It's not too bad after all. Okay? And what will it give us? It will give us an ultimate Alexander invariant. So an Alexander invariant of tangles, which contains the usual Alexander polynomial, of course, and has very good composition properties. So you know how to compute compositions pretty well. Every step in the evaluation is topologically meaningful. So in fact, those messy formulas that I wrote before correspond to certain topological operations. So in some sense, it's the least wasteful that I know of in a computational sense. So if you want to compute, in fact, it is at the end we will get a more efficient algorithm to compute the Alexander polynomial itself. Okay? And if you believe in categorification, I think this would be a wonderful playground, a wonderful thing to try to categorify. I have no idea how. Okay, I'm not sure I have any idea what it would mean. Okay, but it being somehow meaningful on more things than the usual Alexander polynomial, with more meaningful computational steps in between these things, it is a wonderful playground. So it's closely related to work by others quoted here, and there is a short paper on this by myself and Sam Selmani reference here. Okay. Also, I will not mention, at least while it's an introduction, that this is all about knotted balls and circles in R4. Okay. So you're not seeing this transparency right now. Okay. But you will later. It really is all about knotted balls and circles in R4. So again, it being an introduction, I need to start from scratch. Here is a knot. But I think I can skip that. Okay? So here is a knot, and it's marked in many ways. So the crossings are marked plus or minus according to their signs. It's really annoying. And in fact, I don't think it's a mechanical vibration. I think it's electronic, but... Yeah, look, it vibrates relative to the edge. I don't know how much it bothers you, but I stand right next to it, and it's like my world is shaking. Anyway, And it's marked in various otherwise, like for, let's start with the green marking. So this is a marking one, the arcs are numbered, okay? And then let me say that, as I mentioned before, you know, knots are somehow the wrong object to study in knot theory. The right object is tangles, because knots are the finished products, and tangles, or knotted graphs, or there are various other more basic products from which you can assemble knots. And it's much better to study the ingredients than the end result. So one reason is this divide and conquer method that I mentioned when we talked about the Jones polynomial. So if you want to compute the Jones polynomial, it's much better to have a Jones polynomial for tangles, because then you can cut the knot into two pieces. The computation of each piece would be much, much simpler, and then you'll just have to glue the two computations. So really, when I seek invariance, I seek invariance not just of knots, but of tangles, and they should have good composition properties. And to complete the reminder, I'm talking about knots, modulo Rademeister 1, 2, and 3, and 1 is grayed out because often I don't care about it, including today. Okay. So another piece of reminder, there is a standard formula for the Alexander polynomial of a knot. I think when I presented the Alexander polynomial a while ago, I used it for, I defined a more general one, the multivariable Alexander polynomial, which is an invariant of links, and then it's a multivariable thing. If I restrict my attention to knots, it's a tiny bit simpler. And basically, given the crossings, you get a rule how to form a matrix. So the matrix will have rows and columns corresponding to the arcs of the knot. And then if you have a crossing for which the arc adjacent to it are A, B, and C, then in column C you will put in row C, in columns A, B, and C, you will put these entries, and this will form a certain matrix. And to compute the Alexander polynomial, you will remove one row and one column, take the determinant, and that's the Alexander polynomial. Okay, so I actually enter the matrix to my computer, tell it to take row 1 through 7, column 1 through 7, and feed it into the determinant function. I hit enter, and this is the Alexander polynomial of the knot that I had on the screen before, which is 817. So I guess this is the polynomial. I should say that the Alexander polynomial is well defined up to units. So up to multiplication by plus or minus a fixed power of x. So you know, the sequence of numbers that you get here, 1, 4, 8, 11, 8, 4, 1, so is always right, is always the same sequence, but it might be shifted if you multiply by some power of x. Okay? And so issues about these formulas. So first of all, it's very quick to compute, because all that it is it's a determinant, right? But determinants are kind of black boxes. Computing a determinant means feeding it into this, means either of two things. Either you sum over n factorial permutations, and then everything is kind of clear and nice, but it takes n factorial time. Or you do Gaussian elimination. And Gaussian elimination is sort of a black box, because the matrices you see along the way, so at the end you get the right determinant, but the matrices you see along the way, even if the original matrix came somehow from the topology in an understandable way, the matrices that you will see along the way will be completely random matrices that will tell you nothing. So the computation departs from topology. The second point is that this Alexander polynomial extends to tangles, and in fact that was what I did on day zero. I mean, before the master class began, so none of you were here. But I mean, sorry, but anyway, the way to extend it to tangles is to keep track, or one way to extend it to tangles is to try to remember which information you will need in order to complete the computation of a determinant. And it turns out to be you write a corresponding matrix for a tangle. It comes out to be not quite a square matrix, but still you try to figure out what information will you need to retain from this matrix in order to be able to compute its determinant once you complete it to a square matrix. And the answer is you need to know lots and lots of minors of this matrix. The invariant for tangles will be the collection of all such relevant minors, and there is an exponential number of those, so you can extend to tangles, but it has an exponential cost, which completely defeats the purpose of extending to tangles. Okay? I mean, it may have other theoretical purposes, like you could use it to verify identities between tangles. You can do all sorts of other things, but if you want computational efficiency, you've completely defeated the purpose. Okay? Also, it's kind of morally wrong. It means that the invariant, so since there is at the end there is a polynomial amount of information in the Alexander polynomial, but your target space, the collection of all monomials, is of exponential size, it means that you use only a tiny part of it. So it's sort of morally wrong. And these two things together conspire to make the Alexander polynomial hard to categorify, or at least hard to categorify in a way that would extend to tangles so that it would be compatible with tangle operation, with concatenation of tangles. And the reason, well, if you try to just follow the computational route, so use Gaussian elimination as a way to define the Alexander polynomial, well, since Gaussian elimination has no sort of the intermediate steps have no interpretation, you're clueless. You don't know what to do. Also, if you try to categorify the entire invariant of tangles, since it's too big, you'll end up categorifying way more than you intended to. And again, there is no reason to think that this is possible. So I hope to find an Alexander invariant in which the computation is more meaningful and which extends to tangles without the exponential cost. Anyway, well, what? No, I did not mention anything about it. I did not say anything about it. There is a categorification in terms of analysis, so or geometry, or holomorphic curves, or whatever. And then this one has a reduction to combinatorics, but the combinatorics looks completely arbitrary, at least to me. Okay, it doesn't look. And anyway, it does not become useful. It has no useful extension to tangles. Dylan might hate me if he hears me say that, but it's still what I... Dylan Thurston. But I still think this is true. Anyway, well, I mean, that's still better than what I have, right? I have nothing. I'm just telling you a story about the Alexander polynomial, and I'm trying to market it as it's a good version of the Alexander polynomial. Okay? I don't have any categorification, so they're still way better than me. Anyway, So let me start from a silly construction of an invariant. It will fail, but then I'll generalize it, and then it might work, or will work, okay? So here is an idea. Given a group and two so-called Young-Baxter pairs, here is how I would construct an invariant. So, I really need a physical pointer. So what's a Young-Baxter pair? It's a pair of group elements, G sub O and G sub U. And I want two such pairs, so I want a pairs R plus minus, so I'll have G sub O plus and G sub O minus, well, and so on. And the idea is that wherever you see a crossing, you will put on the underside the group element G sub U, on the overstrand the group element G sub O. If it's a positive crossing, you will put the positive pair, and if it's a negative crossing, you will put the negative pair. And then if you have a tangle, then I have group elements written along the strands at the, well, near each crossing, I have one group element on the overside and one group element on the other side. Okay? So my invariant will be just the product of these group elements taken in order along the strand, along each strand. So the invariant will have as many components, as many group elements as an output as there are strands in the tangle. And it's clear how to compose, right? If you concatenate two tangles, you just multiply, you just concatenate the words corresponding to the strands that got concatenated. Okay? So for example, if this is the tangle, well, here I see this is a positive crossing, I go over, so I see GO plus, then GU plus, then GO plus, so GO plus, GU plus, GO plus, and so on. And for the second component, I see GU minus, GO minus. And that's the second component. Okay? Now, this will work if I will find an appropriate group, an appropriate Young-Baxter pair, so that this will be invariant under Rademeister moves. Okay? So you check what conditions on the Young-Baxter pairs are implied by the Young-Baxter moves, by the Rademeister move. And, well, quite immediately you see that Rademeister 2 implies, so right, what's Rademeister 2? Rademeister 2 says that this is equal to that. So the invariant of this, here there is nothing to multiply, so it will be the identity, and the invariant of that will also be the identity. Here you will see GO plus GO minus, so GO plus GO minus for the first strand, and for the second strand you will see GU plus GU minus, and the conclusion is that a certain, well, that the pluses are the inverses of the minuses. Okay? So this is the first condition. And then you look in a similar way at Rademeister 3, and you find that it implies that all the GO plus and GU plus should commute, and therefore all of these group elements should commute. And therefore, the result, the invariant, is just a counting invariant, because everything commutes, so you're just counting how many times you go over and how many times you go under. So at the end, it becomes not even the linking, the full linking matrix. It's just for each component, the sum of all of its linking numbers with all the other components. Okay? So, I mean, it could work, well, it will work, but it doesn't give you much information. So The trick is to generalize, and instead of using a group, I'll use what I will call a meta group. And I think the only thing I want to give you in this hour, or the main thing I want to give you in this hour, is this sort of notion of a meta group. Okay? So what's a meta group? So first of all, what's a group? So the idea is to take some of the group properties and generalize them, but not all. But first, I want to tell you about group computers. So what's a group computer? So a group computer can store data sets that have a certain list of group elements in them. Okay? So for example, it could store a data set in which there is a register called X, a register called U, a register called V, and a register called Y. And then X stores G1, U stores G2, V stores G3, Y stores G4. So each of these registers stores a group element. And then the collection of all data sets with registers X, U, V, Y is just G raised to the finite set X, U, V, Y. Okay? But a group computer not only can store data sets, but it can also manipulate them. It has, you know, machine code commands to manipulate data sets. So for example, one command that it may have, one operation that it may have, is an operation called M up X Y sub Z. This operation has as a domain any data set that has a pair of registers called X and Y. Okay? And has an out, and when you apply this operation, what it does is it removes the registers X and Y, but instead creates a register called Z, which will contain the product of whatever was in X and Y. So in our case, it will be G1 times G4. Okay? So notice that this operation is a unary operation. It's not a binary operation. It comes from the group theoretic binary multiplication, but it's a unary operation because it takes a data set and outputs another data set. Internally, it acts by multiplying two of the registers. But as an operation for our group computer, it takes a single data set and outputs a single data set. Okay? Now, nevertheless, this operation satisfies a certain identity, which is a remnant of associativity. Namely, if you multiply X and Y and store the result in U, and then, so remember that I sometimes use double slash for composition going from left to right. So this just means do this, then do that. And likewise on the right hand side, you do this and then do that. So anyway, if you multiply X and Y, store the result in U, and then multiply U by Z and store the result in V, then overall you've multiplied X, Y, and Z, store the result in V. Okay? And that's the same as multiplying first Y and Z, storing the result in U, and then X and U, and storing the result in V. Okay? So, again, that's an identity of unary operations, which encapsulates or contains in it the meaning of associativity. Now, you see, Group computers comes in different makes. Okay, there is the Intel brand, there is the AMD brand, I don't know. A good group computer should have several further operations. Okay, so there should be an operation called S sub X, which will mean take the inverse of the register X, which will mean it will be an operation taking a data set into a data set, but the way the operation will act will be to invert the content of register X. Okay? An even better group computer will also have an operation for unit insertion. So E sub X will take a data set in which there is no register X, and the output will have a new register called X, which stores the unit. Again, then you may have an operation D sub X for deleting a register, an operation for cloning a register. So if you have a register Z in the input, then in the output it will disappear, but instead you will have two registers, X and Y, that store the same thing. And there will be identities relating Zs, and all of these identities will become unary. Okay? And then maybe you also want a way to rename a register. And finally, there is an operation. I want my group computers to have an operation, a binary operation, a single binary operation. And this binary operation will take two data sets whose set of of register labels are disjoint and merge them. But they have to be disjoint, otherwise I wouldn't know how to merge. So basically you union the two data sets, but the names have to be disjoint, otherwise it doesn't make sense. Okay. And as I mentioned, there are many identities that these operations satisfy in a group computer. Let me mention one further identity. If you start with the data set, X stores G1, Y stores G2. So a data set with two registers, X and Y. Then that data set is equal to the delete Y from P. So P is equal to delete Y from P, union delete X from P. Right? If you delete Y from P, you just get the X. If you delete Y X from P, you just get the Y. And if you union the two, you get the entire data set. Okay? But this axiom is different than this one and all the others that do not involve union, in that it is quadratic. All the other axioms, so in fact this axiom is in some sense linear. It has a single data set appearing on the left and it appears only once. Likewise on the right, the data set which is the input, the data set which is in the input appears only once, and then you apply operations to it. This identity is quadratic. In order to even write this identity, you have to clone the entire data set and then apply an operation to it on the left and before the union, and then apply another operation to it. Okay, so the data set appears twice on the right hand side of this formula. So now I can define a metagroup. So what's a metagroup? It's a similar computer. So from the perspective of the user, it's a black box that tells you I can store group data sets. Give me a finite set of labels, I can store data sets which with pretend registers corresponding to these labels. Okay? So for any finite set gamma, I get a set G sub gamma of all possible data sets labeled by gamma. And then I have a huge collection of operations, MX, YZ, SX, and all the others, okay? Such that MXYZ is defined on every G gamma that in which gamma contains X and Y. And in fact, gamma should not contain Z because I don't want to have name clashes after I produce the output. Okay? But anyway, MXY is defined on many of these G sub gammas. And, you know, I have all the other operations, including the union. So, in other words, if gamma 1 is disjoint from gamma 2, if the two sets of labels of registers are disjoint, then I have an operation G sub gamma 1 times G sub gamma 2 into G sub gamma 1 union gamma 2. Okay? And I insist that this group computer will satisfy the exact same axioms as before, but only the linear axioms. Okay? So dropping the quadratic one. Okay? Yes. I meant equal. Sorry, I just the slash got translated. Okay? Thanks. So let me give you a few examples. First example is the non-meta example. So take an ordinary group G and define G sub gamma to be G up to the power gamma. It's obviously a meta group. It's not interesting. Here's a better example. Here's a nicer example. Oops, I lost myself. Right. So let G sub gamma be the set of gamma by gamma matrices over Z. Okay? With operations, with simultaneous row and column operations. So if you want to add register X to register I, to register Y, then remember that my, you know, the way the, so internally, a data set is a matrix whose rows and columns are both labeled by gamma. If I want to add X to Y, what I will do is I will merge these two columns and at the same time merge the two rows. So basically I will get a matrix whose Z entry will be the sum of these four entries, whose Z by Z entry will be the sum of all these four entries. The remainder of the Z row will be the sum of the corresponding rows. The remainder of the Z column will be the sum of the corresponding columns, and the rest of the matrix will be untouched. Okay? It's easy to check that... and I should have also... similarly for all other unary operations, and for the union, take the block diagonal merge. So if you have one matrix with some set of labels and another matrix with some other set of labels, just take the block diagonal sum and you got a matrix corresponding to the union of the two sets of labels. Okay? So it's easy to check that all the unary axioms are satisfied. However, the exceptional axiom is not satisfied. So for example, so a data set P which stores two registers XY will look like a 2x2 matrix. The columns are also labeled X and Y, but I didn't bother to mention it. If you delete Y, then you're deleting the row Y and the column Y, so you're left only with a 1x1 matrix storing A. Likewise, if you delete X, you're left only with D. And if you merge these two matrices, you get the following block diagonal matrix, which is not the matrix you started from. So this example is truly meta. Okay? Now, if you know anything about... I should say that there are many other examples, okay? But I'm not sure I want to go through the whole list, but... Well, the tensor powers of a Hopf algebra would be one example. Okay? Next. I should have said it before, even. So, if you have a meta group G and a pair of of Young-Baxter elements in G2, then the construction that I suggested for a tangle invariant completely makes sense. Namely, suppose I wanted to construct an invariant, say, for this tangle, okay? I will take the Young-Baxter element corresponding to this crossing, store it in a data set with labels, let me go to the labeled example. So I will take the, where was it? Here. I will take the data set corresponding to a positive, to a negative crossing, store it on under labels 1 and 12, and then I will make another copy of that data set, or I will take another copy of that data set, store it under data sets, under registers 2 and 7, and then another copy and store it under in registers 3 and 8, and so on. And then I will take the merge of all of these data sets. They have disjoint labels, so I can do it. And then I will just multiply or tell the computer to virtually multiply, to meta-multiply, the registers 1 and 2 store the result in 1. Then 1 and 3 store the result in 1. Then 1 and 4 store the result back in 1. And at the end, I will have this meta product of all of those meta Young-Baxter elements stored in register 1. And that will be my invariant. Okay? So in principle, the system still makes sense. Are you okay? Is this more or less understandable? Okay. You see, because this is where it gets a little bit more complicated. The problem is that, just like in ordinary group theory, the first few examples of groups you construct by hand. And then, to get more sophisticated examples, you need how to construct from a small example a bigger example. So, like if you have two groups, how to form their semi-direct product or their bi-cross product. Okay? So now forget about meta for a little while, and I want to tell you about bi-cross products of ordinary groups. And after that, I will give you the meta version of that. And then that will allow me to construct the meta group which computes the Alexander invariant. Okay? So suppose you have a group G, and you know that it is the product of two of its subgroups with intersection equal to the empty set. Sorry, the identity. Okay? Two non-intersecting subgroups. Okay, then it's a lovely exercise that the group is also the product of T. So if you can write G as head times tails, so H times T, it's a lovely exercise to verify that G is also T times H. Okay, furthermore, because the intersection is empty, every element of the group can be uniquely written as a product of something from H with something from T, but also as a product of something from T with something from H. Okay? So, you know, let me lower it so I can touch it. And then the claim is that the group is completely determined by the two subgroups, H and T, and also a swap map that takes a pair T, H to a pair H prime T prime defined by, well, look at T times H, you can write it in a unique way as an H times T, so that will define H prime and T prime. Okay? The swap map satisfies two easy properties. namely, and also a few even easier properties. So these are the actually harder properties. So the swap map satisfies the following two properties. So my color convention, I guess, is that I use blue for H's, for heads, and red for tails. So the properties are, well, if you want to swap two tails, the product of two tails over a head, then you can either multiply the two, you can either multiply the two tails and then swap, or swap the first and then swap the second and then multiply. You can write it as tail multiply of 1 and 2, call this one 1 and this one 2, storing the result in 1 and then swapping 1 against 4 is the same as swapping 2 against 4, then swapping 1 against 4, then tail multiplying 1 and 2. Okay? And likewise, there is a similar axiom, which I didn't even bother to write explicitly, about swapping two heads against a tail. Okay? And the claim is that if you have two groups, H and T, plus a swap map going from T cross H to H cross T, and the swap map satisfies these two properties and also a lesser properties about the identity. These are the interesting properties. So then this information allows you to put a new group structure on the Cartesian product of H and T and the so-called bicross product. And that is a group structure. Okay, this really is a group structure. It's associative and all. So how do you do that? Well, if you have an H cross T pair and another H cross T pair, and I want to multiply them, what I need to do is, so again, if I have an H times T pair and another H times T pair, and I want to compute their product using the operations I have, well, what I need to do is I need to swap these two. So I need to apply the swap map to the middle two. And then I just need to multiply the resulting two heads and the resulting two tails. Graphically, I swap the tails of one with the heads of the other, and then I multiply heads and multiply tails. In formula language, it means that I define the group multiply of the pair one with the pair two, giving an output pair three, to be swap the tail of one with the head of two. Swap always swaps a tail with a head, so I don't need to specify it. Then tail multiply the tail of one with the tail of two into the tail of three, and then head multiply. Okay? All of these things were written in completely a unary way. So all of this could be generalized for the meta context. But I think I'm running out of time. Am I right?
Yeah.
So maybe I'll stop and continue after the break and tell you how to do it in the meta context, and then tell you how to do it for the Alexander polynomial, and then the challenge for the afternoon will be to derive this from the W stuff that we did yesterday. Okay.